Well, good morning to everybody. It is truly a pleasure to see everybody that has come out and joined us today. And one slight correction on the announcements is Glenda won't be going home Monday or Tuesday. She will probably be going into rehab Monday or Tuesday. And I would echo Aaron's thoughts of wishing everyone a happy Valentine's Day. And I apologize, I missed the memo about wearing red. So what you see is what you get. Last week during class, my eye caught the fact that we were missing one of the plates for the door. And it was one of those things, you squirrel, you know, you're talking along and all of a sudden your eye catches something and you go, oh, wait a minute. And your train of thought completely disappears. But that has been fixed. And if you look, we've got all new hardware on the doors. And so we are greatly appreciative, as it was announced, for all of the effort and work that is going on here at the building. We have been in a series of lessons on heroes of the Bible. And we're looking at different individuals who show a characteristic or a trait or in their lives something that we can possibly take, put into our lives to help us become a hero for God. In this continuation of our series, we will be having today a discussion of Esther. And you might remember the story of Esther. It takes place in the days of Ahasuerus, that guy. This is the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia and over 127 provinces. Now, I've mentioned that I'm a movie buff, and I am. I love to watch movies. I rarely ever turn on any of the serial things or the programs that TV has. I try and find a movie somewhere that I can watch. And just so you know, my criteria is if guns don't go off or bombs don't go off in the first 5 minutes, then the movie's probably not worth watching. I don't go to movie theaters. I sit at home. But there was a movie that came out a while back called 300. And it's a fictional retelling of the historical Battle of Thermopylae. In that battle, the Spartan commander Leonidas led a group, in reality, in the movie it was 300, but in reality it was a group of about 7,000 soldiers to hold the pass at Thermopylae against the advance of the Persians. During the course of the battle, when it became obvious that they would not succeed in holding the pass, Leonidas sent the bulk of his army back and retained about 1,000 soldiers to try and delay the advance of the Persians. The commander of the advancing Persian army was Xerxes. In all reality, probably Xerxes I, and I'm watching James to see if he starts doing this. Because James is our historian on this era. Fantastic class that we've been going through on the intertestamental period, which is this 400-year time frame when all of the things are occurring that Daniel prophesied about in the statue of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. That's Xerxes. And Xerxes is considered by most scholars and commentators to be this king, Ahasuerus. That's supposedly considered by most to be this Xerxes I. That gives us the historical setting for this account that we read in the book of Esther. In the biblical setting for our lesson, we see King Ahasuerus has thrown a party for his generals, his underlings, his province leaders. And maybe the better way to say it is that he has invited all of these underlings to come and see how great a king he is. And during the course of this party, verse 10 of chapter 1 tells us that on the seventh day of the party, this is a long party. You think you go to a long party and it lasts for an hour or so? No, this one's going on for 7 days. And the king, the heart of the king is merry with wine. The king has become drunk. And unfortunately, as with many who become drunk, they lose their judgment, their common sense, their inhibition. So to further put on the display of ostentatiousness, of look how good and great I am, King Ahasuerus sends for his queen Vashti. In verse 11, we're told that he has sent his eunuchs to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. Apparently, Vashti was a trophy wife. And the king wanted to show her off, wanted to display her. Now, at this point, speculation begins to run a little rampant. Because you see, Vashti refuses the summons. She does not come before the king. And the question gets posed, why? Why did Vashti refuse? What was there about the king's request that caused her to say, no, I don't think that's going to happen? Some say he wanted her to dance and to put on a show of some sort. The Targum, which is the Jewish oral translation of the reading of the old law of the Hebrew, includes the statement that he requested that she come without clothing, to dance nude before all of his underlings, to show his complete power and dominance. That is not necessarily substantiated by the scriptures. Regardless of why, Vashti refuses to come. And unfortunately for Vashti, her drunken husband was also the king. So he calls for his advisors and he wants to know what they think. And in verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti, his queen, may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who was more worthy than she. Vashti refused the king's request, and now she's going to be outed as the queen. She will be banished. That sets the scene for us. Ahasuerus, the great god king, as he perceived himself, especially if he was indeed Xerxes the First, has removed Vashti as the queen. And now he's got to replace her. Cyrus, who had ascended to the throne after Nebuchadnezzar, had decreed that those of the Jews who wanted to could return to Jerusalem to begin rebuilding the temple. But interestingly, and as we've talked about in the intertestamental class, not all the Jews were required to go back. In chapter 2 of Esther, in verse 5 beginning, there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Mordecai was a Jew who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up, he was raising Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, basically his cousin, because she had no father or mother. That's what family does. Mordecai has taken in his young cousin to raise her because she has no father or mother. Kish, the ancestor of Mordecai, had been carried away with Jeconiah, and that's approximately 599 to 597 BC. I keep waiting. James hasn't started shaking his head yet, so I'm still good. So Mordecai was contemporary with Xerxes I, which kind of harmonizes with the idea that maybe Ahasuerus is indeed Xerxes. Mordecai, a Jew, is raising his cousin, and he and Esther live in Susa, the Persian royal city, also called Shushan. Now, we're not specifically told, but there seems to be some indication that Mordecai has a position of authority, which maybe is why he didn't go back with the Jews when they were allowed to return to Jerusalem. Because it says in verse 21 that in those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, that tends to be a position of authority. Speculation, that's all this is. Typically what you would find sitting at the gate, and we see this with the Jews, we also see this in Proverbs 31, where the woman there is taking care of the house so that her husband can sit at the gates. This was a position where the people would come and they would bring their issues, lay them at the feet of those that were sitting there, and they would get advice. And that whoever was in rule or in charge would also come to them and get advice on occasion. The advisors that came to Ahasuerus when Vashti had refused to come to him, those advisors may very well have been sitting at the gate with Mordecai. So there's implication that Mordecai holds some sort of position of authority. So now after Vashti has been dismissed for defying the king's commandment, the king gives a decree. And it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. This is talking about Hegai, not the king. Esther, in whatever she was doing, the guy liked her. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. I find it interesting how the providence of God uses things. We see Joseph, who winds up going into Egypt, becomes the servant, the slave to Potiphar, and he finds favor with Potiphar. Then because of Potiphar's wife, Joseph gets thrown in prison. And know what happens there? He finds favor with those in prison. He begins to interpret dreams. When Pharaoh had a dream, nobody could interpret it for him. Joseph is brought out of prison, and guess what? He finds favor with Pharaoh to the point that Pharaoh makes him number 2 in all the land of Egypt. He answers only to Pharaoh. Talk about a position of authority. Look at Daniel. Daniel finds pretty much the same story when you really think about it, isn't it? Winds up in prison, interprets some dreams. Nebuchadnezzar finds out about it, brings Daniel out, and Daniel interprets his dreams. Why? Because God's with him. Now, we're not told specifically that God is with Esther, but we can definitely see the providence of God, the hand of God moving events that are occurring. She's among those maidens in the kingdom that have been gathered in response to the king's decree. Remember what the king had been told? Get rid of Vashti and replace her with someone who is more worthy. So that's why all of these young ladies have been brought before the king. She's one of those who has been chosen out of all of these young ladies to hopefully or to become a part of the king's harem and maybe replace Vashti. So as we continue reading, beginning in verse 12 of chapter 2, now when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women. So this isn't happening like immediate. There's a time frame. There's 12 months. That's a year. For the days of their beautification were completed as followed. 6 months with oil and myrrh. 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. Basically, these gals went to a spa. And they were being prepared to be presented to the king. The young lady would then go into the king in this way. Anything that she would desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the custody of... Shh, guys. The king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. We can see a lot wrong with this, no question. But there's an underlying current that is going on that needs to be taken care of. So in due time, it became Esther's turn to go into the king. And when it was her turn, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king. She did not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. This is at a time when his power was at its zenith. He was at his peak. He could do anything and have anything he wanted. Beginning in verse 17, and the king loved Esther more than all the women. She found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. And he also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. When you watch a movie, you watch a whole, if it's a 2-hour movie, you watch an hour and a half of preparation, laying the groundwork for the climax that is coming. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing the preparation for a climax that is coming. This is the point in the account when the plot begins to thicken. In verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, they became angry, and they sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. They're plotting against the king. They're going to overthrow him. That's what's under discussion. There's the plot that's beginning to grow. And here's another indication that Mordecai held some position of authority, official position. He still had some type of access to Esther, who was the queen. Beginning in verse 22, but the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. When the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows. That's Bigthan and Teresh. And it was written in the book of Chronicles in the king's presence. Wow! Nice climax. Except that's not the climax. That's just a rise in the plot. The climax is yet to come. Mordecai saved the king's life. But his next actions set the stage for the real climax, the real drama. As we continue reading in verse 1, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, an advanced... I'm going to have to start picking passages that don't have all these names in them. Whew! And advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate, remember where Mordecai sat, bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But guess what? Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Haman was beside himself that Mordecai wouldn't pay him homage. But remember, Mordecai was a Jew. He was also the man who had saved the king's life. Haman made the decision not to go after Mordecai, but rather to go after the Jews. This is Haman. He disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Remember how this king rules. You don't do anything without the king's permission. So while Haman's plotting to destroy the Jews, he also understands that's not a decision he can make on his own. So what does he do? So we continue reading in chapter 3, beginning in verse 8. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all those or from those of all other people. They do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it's pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry out the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, the silver's yours, and the people also. You go do with them as you please. The protagonist has been defined. Haman is the enemy of the Jews. He had set his trap well. He had lured the king right into it. Haman didn't know, didn't recognize what was going on. He gave Haman exactly what he wanted. He gave him the king's blessing to seek his revenge not only on these people, but on Mordecai and on Esther. the queen because they were Jews. Well, Esther finds out from Mordecai what's happening. So she prepares her course of action, and she does it well. She begins by inviting the king and Haman, the enemy, to a private banquet with an invitation to another banquet the following day. Haman is ecstatic when he sees as a complete acceptance of his plan by both the king and the queen. The implication there is that Haman doesn't have a clue that Esther's a Jew. In his joy and elation, he goes out the gate, and there sits Mordecai. And again, Mordecai does not bow down or pay homage. Haman is vehement. He goes, his anger is such that he goes and builds a gallows. If you've ever seen any Western movies, you probably know what a gallows is. It's a framework where they would build and then hang people. 50 cubits high. A cubit is about 18 inches. 50 times 18 is 75 feet. Think how high that is. Most of these tall trees that we see around here are 20 to 30 feet high. 75 feet. If one story equates to about 9 feet, add it up. 7 stories high, plus almost to 8. That's a big framework just to hang somebody. But that's what he built. Well, in the meantime, the king, Ahasuerus, has discovered that it was Mordecai who had revealed the plot of Bigthan and Teresh to kill him. And he's discovered that Mordecai has never been rewarded. So the king decides that he's going to reward him. And this I love. Guess who he tells to go tell Mordecai, to give Mordecai one of the king's robes and a horse? Haman, the guy who hates Mordecai. Well, Haman does that. And then he goes home in fear because he's just realized that Mordecai is one of the king's favorites. He goes home and he talks to his wife. And while he's talking with her, the messengers come to take him to the second banquet that has been planned by Esther. And at the feast, the king again offers Esther whatever she wants, up to half the kingdom. Boy, did she reel him in. Just like Haman did. Esther looks at him and says, oh, I don't want much. All I want is that she and her people will be saved from a plot to exterminate them. The king goes ballistic. He's angry. Notice what he asks Esther. Who is he? Where is he? Who would presume to do such a thing? Ahasuerus was so upset with Haman that he went into the garden. And while he was there, Haman began to beg Esther for his life. When the king returned from the garden, the plot keeps getting thicker. He finds Haman, who has thrown himself onto Esther's couch. Beginning to sound like a movie or something you'd see, huh? When the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And notice what the king says. Is he even going to assault the queen with me in the house? Haman's made some bad choices. So in the final analysis, Haman is hung on the very gallows that he had built for Mordecai. The decree to destroy the Jews is revoked. Mordecai is given the king's signet ring on his right hand, and he replaces Haman as the number two man in the kingdom. And the Jews fight back against those that had gone out to destroy them and wind up winning the fight against their enemies. But as Paul Harvey used to say, now the rest of the story. Remember that what we are looking at these different individuals to try to see something in them that we can take, that we can apply, that can help make us a hero for God. What is it about Esther that we see? It shows many things. We see the power of God, his providence, if you will, and how things just seem to work out for the best. God moved events so that when the time finally came, that the real danger is revealed. There were those that were in a position that could stop the danger. We see the loyalty of Esther, both to her people and to Mordecai. We see her commitment. Mind you, this king has already taken one queen and cast her out because he didn't like what she was doing. That danger is still very real. And yet Esther moved to save her people. The loyalty and the attribute of loyalty that we see in Esther, that we saw in Ruth when we talked about her as one of our heroes, is a very important attribute for any who would be a child of God. Her commitment to Mordecai and the Jews saved their lives. And remember, Haman's decree covered all the provinces of the kingdom, which included Judah, so that those that had gone back to rebuild the temple would have been part of the genocide that Haman was planning. Haman would be given that authority. Ask yourself, what am I willing to give up to be a child of God? What am I willing to endure to be a child of God? What danger am I willing to face to be a child of God? You see, we become a child of God when we keep his commandments, when we do what God wants us to do, when we are faithful and obedient to God, Christ, and the word that they have given us. That's how we become a child of God. Well, what am I willing to do? God says the disciples gathered together on the first day of the week to take communion, to break bread, the Lord's Supper. Am I willing to do that? Or do I have something in my mind that says, oh, I don't need to do it every week? Even though that's the example we see in Acts 27. Scriptures tell us to sing and make melody in our hearts. Yeah, but you know, I can't carry a tune in the bucket. So I think it's better if I bring up a band or an orchestra. Or maybe just I'll pick a few of you that really have good voices and we'll make a choir up here and I can sit and listen. But you see, that's not God's commandment. God's commandment is to all of us, sing and make melody in your heart. God doesn't care if we can't carry a tune in the bucket. God says, sing. What does the world see when they look at me? Do they see someone who is willing to stand up for God, to stand up for the Word, and to teach it. The whole nation of the Jews would have been eradicated had not Esther stepped forward. How many people out there might lose their souls because I'm not willing to go and teach? You want to be a hero for God? Jesus says, if you love me, keep my commandments. God gives an invitation to any and to all. He says, come unto me, all ye that labor, and I will give you rest. He wants us to hear his word and to believe it, to turn our will to his will, to confess Jesus as the Christ like the eunuch did, and to be baptized in the watery grave of baptism, to be raised into a newness of life, Romans chapter 6. And he wants us to continue to live our lives in such a manner that we are faithful and obedient. If you haven't been baptized, you are lost. If you haven't been faithful and obedient, you are lost. God invites all to come to him, and he will give them rest. That's God's invitation, which we offer at this time as together we stand and sing.